I got the fella on the line, we're all set to go. Good evening. Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us David Morgan. We're going to be talking about what's happening in the world today financially and, of course, what you can do. Now, the ultimate protection for any of us is in our relationship with the Lord, and certainly we're never going to get through what lies ahead because very, very bad times do lie ahead without the Lord's help and support, and some of us may not get through this. But it behooves us to make the preparations, to have the understanding, to understand what happens to a nation that turns its back on God. And when, of course, the Episcopal bishops vote, it's perfectly our right to ordain a bishop who left his wife and children for another man because, after all, the Holy Spirit told him it was all right to do it. It doesn't matter what it says in the Bible. As long as the Holy Spirit tells you it's all right, it's all right. And I suspect the Spirit did tell him what to do, but I don't think it was the Holy Spirit of the Bible. Under any circumstances, we're witnessing, I think, the most dangerous and difficult financial times in the history of our nation. David, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Why don't you sort of give our listeners a little of your background? And remember, these people do not know you. You haven't been on my program in this area before. So you give the background, and don't be afraid to repeat any of the things we've said on previous programs.
Okay, Stan. Well, I went to school and got an engineering degree, although my true love was really finance. After I worked as an engineer for a short time, I went back to school and got a business degree in international finance and economics. And I've studied the silver market for over two decades. I was kind of late to the party. I was pretty young. I was in my 20s when gold and silver took off from the early 70s, really. But through the late 70s into 1980, and I'd read quite a bit about the gold and silver markets from the established or the unestablishment types at the time, like Howard Ruff, Doug Casey, Jim Dines. Oh, there's several others, none of them come to mind presently. But I had a pretty good background from there, and basically I started publishing my own newsletter about 5 years ago that focuses on the precious metals and emphasizes silver investing.
All right, fine. Well, of course, a lot of people are going to say, well, gee, I've been hearing about this for a long time, and I bought silver back in 1980 at $50 an ounce, and look, it ended up down about $2.50, $3 an ounce, and we're always hearing we're going to run out of silver, or, there's a tremendous demand for silver, but, nothing's happened. Now, sure, we got up to $5 here recently, but we backed off from that, and of course, everything's really great, and we've got smart people in control. We've got Alan Greenspan controlling the monetary system. So why should we be really worried? After all, aren't we coming out of the recession? Of course, there may be a jobless recovery, and I'm not quite sure what a jobless recovery is, but the market may be up, but we're really not making much in the way of profits in our industries. There are no new jobs being formed. In fact, more people are losing their jobs every single week. Cannon, who makes the sheets and so many of the things, the towels, things that we've used for years, they're just shutting down. Almost 200,000, 250,000 textile jobs have been lost in the last couple of years. They're all going overseas, along with so many of our other products. And recently, of course, the president has given a $400 check to everybody with a child in America. We're talking 20 or 30 million people, some of them with two or three children. Boy, all that money going to be used to stimulate the economy. People are going to go out and spend that $400. And this gets, of course, into billions and billions of dollars. And that's going to stimulate the economy in China and Japan and, of course, South Korea. But it's not going to stimulate the economy here because the things that the people are buying are not the things that are made here because all of our jobs are being systematically and intentionally shipped overseas. Would that be a fair appraisal of what's going on?
Yeah, I think it's pretty darn accurate. We talked on one of your previous shows about, you know, the total debt, and I have a number for you this time. It's $44.2 trillion. That's all what's accounted for on the books and off the book debts. But if you break that down into, by the population of the United States, approximately 275 million people, you're looking at about a huge, amount per person. And what people must understand is their credit card payments or any interest bearing instrument. The interest compounds, and what that means, obviously, most people know this, is that that's today's debt, but tomorrow it's a little bit higher because of the compounding of the debt. That money is made by a privately held corporation. It's called the Federal Reserve, and that private corporation gets the money from the Treasury, and the Treasury prints the money for the Federal Reserve at cost and sells it to them at cost. So if you have a $1 bill or a $5 bill or a $20 bill or a $100 bill, the Federal Reserve pays the Treasury 3 cents for that money. Now, it doesn't matter if it's a 1 or if it's a 100, it still pays 3 cents. Then it takes that very same money and it loans it to the federal government at face value plus interest. So if you look at the long bond, for example, we're near 5% on the long bond, you're going to get, for $100, you're going to get $105. That's a pretty good game, Stan. I think there's not too many people out there that have that profitable business that you can get somebody to do the work for you, pay them what it costs them to make it, which is 3 cents each, and then go ahead and loan it at the face value. And that's basically how the system works. The downside of that is that those type of systems, since they're so untruthful, they're so unethical, and they're so immoral, that eventually they fail. And I believe strongly that we are near the end of that system working. And it's based on a lot of my monetary history. Normally you see those type of systems fail at around a 30-year time frame. We witnessed the close of the gold window. There used to be, some of the older listeners are probably familiar with these terms. Sound as a dollar as good as gold. Those terms did apply as short a time ago, say 1969, for example, because in 1969, we were on the international gold standard. You and I didn't know much about gold standard, but internationally, France was able to say, well, we've got this many U.S. dollars, and we want to trade it for gold. That was the agreement of the Bretton Woods, and we're going to send it over and send us the gold, and that started happening. And some of President Nixon's advisors got with him and said, look, we can't allow this to happen much longer. We're going to be out of gold. And, of course, that was the truth. So in August of 1971, Richard Nixon closed the gold window and said, we're no longer honoring our contracts. We're going to base the dollar. We're going to make it a floating currency. And we're going to base it on the productivity of the people. It's going to be based upon what America can produce. Well, as you started the introduction, Stan, we don't produce much in this country anymore. And if you go to my economic background, which I'm not an Austrian school graduate, I wish I could say I was, but that was the way I leaned, and definitely my thinking over the last 10 years is the von Mises type of thinking, the Austrian school, which is not taught very much in this country at all. But in the classic sense, the means of production is capital. In other words, whatever you can produce something. Well, since we're producing very little, most of our jobs are service-oriented. Those are the type of situations where if you have a liquidity crisis or you have a country that isn't producing much and all you have is service jobs, they get hurt the worst, because most service jobs you can do yourself. You can wash your own car, for example, instead of going to the car wash. You can cut your own grass, for example, instead of having a lawn boy cut your lawn, or do your pool service, or these type of things. And unfortunately, that's the type of situation America is in for a great part of it. I mean, we used to be the industrial powerhouse of the world, but that no longer exists here. It exists in Asia, basically. So what I foresee is a very large dispersion of capital to the east, and I see those countries that have all this capital being able to repatriate those dollars and probably buy up most of America if they so choose to do so. On the other side, that's the asset side. On the liability side, we're the ones that have loaned all the money. We're the ones that owe it. That doesn't hold well for us. So I do believe we have some very interesting times ahead, to put it politely. Exactly what will happen, I don't know. I know from monetary history there's usually huge shifts, and there's a lot of dislocations, let's say, in the economy. And we're witnessing that now, as you well know.
Well, I think it's so interesting. In 1930s, they said, there's an overproduction capacity. In other words, industry had the tremendous ability to produce a lot more than was needed. You could produce all these refrigerators and all these cars and all these various things that people were buying at that time. And, of course, there weren't enough people buying because there were so many people being laid off of work. So you had overproduction and under capacity for purchasing. Well, right today, of course, we don't have that overcapacity production because we have sent most of our industries intentionally and purposely offshore to share the wealth. We believe from each according to his ability, to each according to their need. The major thrust of American foreign policy, and they're certainly not going to tell the American people this, is to transfer the wealth to the middle class throughout the rest of the world so we can all live happily together in this wonderful new utopian world that's coming, the new world order, the new world religion. But, of course, this has a tremendous impact on the ability of Americans to get good-paying jobs. And even certainly many of our good-paying white-collar jobs are support for computers. You call Dell Computer now and ask for support on your new Dell computer, and you may very well find yourself talking to a very nice fellow named Joe who lives in Pakistan or Bangladesh or India. And, of course, that's where you're getting your support. And the same thing is happening with so many of the things. They're taking CAT scans in many of our major hospitals and shipping them to India to get them read so we don't have to pay money to American radiologists. And there's so many of the jobs, selling jobs, telephone jobs, that can be done in India just as readily as they can here through the miracle of satellite and electronics. So even many of our good white-collar jobs are going overseas. Then the government is, of course, making special visas so you can bring an Indian into this country to replace a fellow who's getting $40 an hour with somebody who's getting $12 an hour from India who's glad to have that job. And little bit by little bit, without the knowledge of the American people, because this is being carefully covered up by the controlled media, why the American people are losing the foundations of our whole economic system. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, I think it's pretty accurate. I'd just like to comment on two things. One, as you probably well know, Stan, but maybe many of the listeners don't, utopia translated means nowhere, so we're going nowhere. And secondly, I would like to emphasize what you said about the middle class. If you study monetary history, what you find is the middle class is usually wiped out in these situations. And it's my best effort to inform the people and let them make their own decisions. But one of the most undervalued asset classes in all commodities, as far as I'm concerned, through my study, it's just not willy-nilly, is the silver market.
All right. So why is that?
Well, first of all, I want to give you a little history. If we look at the 1850s, for example, the 1800s, I'm going to back up even further than that. I'm going to digress a bit, then I'm going to come back and make my main point. But there was a cartoon that was in the popular media. It was called Another Day, Another Dollar. And it was usually centered around some situation in everyday life, and it was a joke. But the title of the cartoon, Another Day, Another Dollar, held significance in the 18th century because the average worker, the middle class, made a dollar a day. And that was a silver dollar, of course. And a silver dollar, as you may recall, is only 3/4 of an ounce of silver. But that was a decent pay for the time period. Now, to prove how undervalued that is, if we took what the Treasury says we have in gold, which is about 265 million ounces, I'm not sure that we have it, but that's what the Treasury reports, so we'll just take them at their word. And we divide that by the amount of people in America, which is roughly 275 million people. What we'll find is we would get roughly 1 ounce per person if we divided it all equally, like the socialists would have us do. If we did it with silver, we'd find a very interesting situation. If we go back into about the 1940s, we had over 2 billion ounces of silver held by the United States government. However, today we are totally 100% completely out of silver. So there would be none available through the government to give to anyone. Now, what is stockpiled in bullion form right now is between 300 million and 500 million ounces. So basically, there's less silver available for investment than there is gold. As absurd as that statement may sound, it definitely can be proven, it can be backed up, and I suggest, before we get further into the show, that anyone that's interested in verifying these facts, go to my website, silver-investor.com, go to the archives section, and start reading. Certainly don't want to read everything tonight. You'll probably get you'll get blinded by your computer screen. But there's a lot of work, a lot of effort on my part and others that will bring you the truth about the silver market. Having said all that, to say this, silver is probably the most undervalued commodity on the planet right now. I am for the common man. I am for the middle class. I don't want to see it wiped out. I think the best way you can protect yourself is in the silver market. I have absolutely nothing against gold. I think gold is a viable currency. It's well recognized. It's almost a mainstream investment now. Some of the larger brokerage houses are recommending gold, and I'm all for that. I also think that you should probably own some gold. However, for the little guy, I think that silver is probably going to offer the best protection. Now, obviously, as you said, Stan, silver's done nothing for the last several years. One of the first interviews that I participated in, actually the first one, was with Don McIlvaney of McIlvaney Intelligence Alert. And Don had just written an article about the silver market, and then he called and did a radio interview with me to kind of verify some of his work, and we just kind of talked the silver market back and forth. After that, I was asked to do an interview with a man named Jim Poplava, who does financialsense.com. And in my first interview, we did one called Silver Manipulation and Fundamentals. And in that interview, we talked about how the market moves and how the derivatives market or the futures market controls the price. I'm not going to go into that tonight. We'll probably have some other questions and some callers will call in. But basically, the essence of it is this. After the Hunt situation in 1979, we did have momentarily a surplus of silver because a lot of silver came into the market. Very little traded at $50 the ounce, by the way, because it only hit that price for a couple of days. But it did stay up above 10 for quite some time. A lot of silver came into the market, and that held in a surplus category until 1990. From 1990 to present day, we've been running a deficit. In other words, more silver is being used either for investment and industry than is being mined out of the earth. If you take a look at both those curves, or the amount of metal, the surplus and the deficit, right now, today, they're roughly equal, which implies strongly that we're very tight in the silver market. And the price will reflect that at some point in the future. Now, already we've seen $5, which certainly doesn't sound like much, but when you consider the fact that it hit $3.50 the ounce in 1990, I forget the year, I think it was 93, it's significantly higher than that. And the other thing is that the powers that be are very interested in keeping gold and silver managed into lower prices so that people don't pay much attention to them.
Well, don't you think that they really manage most of the commodities, but silver is certainly the one that perhaps the individual might be able to profit from?
Absolutely. I mean, they do manage them all. I mean, it can be shown in the oil market. It can be shown in the in all the grains. I mean, corn, wheat. You can take entities that actually or large corporations that own and produce most of the grains, for example, and you'll see that they're selling these things at rather ridiculous prices, but the way they profit is they go into the futures market and they get the public to trade these futures contracts, and they actually take it to them, so to speak. So, yes.
Now, first, the thing, if I could say one thing about the futures market, because I've watched it for many years, the futures market is a wonderful way to make a small fortune out of a large fortune. do not get into that. It's a sucker strap. It's a crooked from the day it was, unless, of course, you are a farmer and you actually have the product to deliver, you certainly don't want to play their game, because it's all stacked, and they win, you lose, is the way it goes. 95% of the people who play the commodities lose, making a small fortune out of a large one. We'll be right back here with David Morgan in just a moment, and we'll welcome your calls here at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is David Morgan, and really I'm having him on because I happen to believe he's right, and I believe that people have to do everything they can to protect themselves. They have to be diversified. That's something I think that, and I've felt this for a long time, that something that has a tremendous upside potential, and whether it'll be 6 months or a year or 3 or 4 years from now, but it is not going to be too much in the future, is, of course, the silver market, because there is much more consumption than there is production. Do we have any idea, David, actually how much silver is available in the market today and how much is being consumed every year?
Yes, we do. First of all, as far as what's consumed every year, it does vary from year to year. And to be honest, the last 3 years or so has actually diminished a little bit. But if you take the average over the last 10 years, what you find is that we basically are consuming 120 million ounces per year more than we're able to produce out of the ground. So if you break that down on a monthly basis, it's about 10 million ounces per month that are being eaten up out of the above-ground stockpiles. And as far as how much exists, I think I'll go back to the gold example, where if we took all the treasury gold divided by the population of the United States, it'd equal 1 ounce per person. Right now, the best estimates in the world are that there's between 300 million and 500 million ounces of silver.
That's in the whole world?
In silver bullion, yeah. Right. I'm going to take the low number, so this, you know, for the listeners, the most bullish case, okay? It's the most extremely bullish case. But let's say there is 300 million ounces, and that's right. Well, if you divide that by 275 million people in the United States, you'll see that there's just a little over an ounce per person. However, out of 300 million ounces that exist, 130 million ounces of that belongs to Mr. Warren Buffett, which leaves 170 million ounces. And of the 170 million ounces that exists, 105 million ounces is sitting on the COMEX warehouses, or actually the banks that are as designees of COMEX warehouses. They're really banks that they're referred to as warehouses. So that would leave 65 million ounces that's readily available.
But now, isn't there an awful lot out there? People are still holding silver coins going back.
Absolutely. If we add the coins in, there's roughly 500 million ounces of coin-form silver, which is either silver eagles, rare coins, silver rounds are considered coins. All that type of coinage would be 500 million. So if you add the coins with the bullion, you're up to about 1 billion ounces total. And if you look at all of the gold market, you're looking at about 3 billion ounces total.
All right. So now what about other countries? Are other countries, the people there, are beginning to collect silver? Because I know traditionally silver was sort of a sign of wealth in India. The Indian people, the billion people who live there, really had sort of a real affinity for silver.
Well, that's true. I mean, approximately 4,000 tons of silver are consumed annually in India. The vast majority is used in production of ornamental items such as jewelry, utensils, gift articles, that kind of thing. And the industrial part of that 4,000 tons only is about 300 tons, which is about 8% of the total that's used on an annual basis. Only about 8% or less than 8% is actually used in industry. In India, the rural communities are very big fans of silver, and they consider it a hedge against inflation, and they also use it as their main investment. For example, a lot of the farming communities in India, the farmer will actually bury silver along with planting his crops, and if he has a crop failure, they'll just dig up the silver and get by for the next year from their savings. That's a tradition. Really,
Well, Robert, okay, our guest this evening is David Morgan. We're sort of talking about what's happening in the world of silver. And, of course, David was pointing out that certainly in India, silver is a very, very attractive product, and there's a lot of it used in, certainly as a storehouse of wealth. A lot of it is used, for ornaments. Indian rural population has always relied upon silver as a barrier against inflation, because, of course, this is what always wipes out the middle class, and the people there really a lot smarter than the American people. They don't have the Time magazine and U.S. News and of course, Newsweek magazine to confuse their outlook. They probably aren't looking at that much of Barbara Walters, Dan Rather, and Tom Brokaw. And so they use this good common sense to try to survive. And this is one way they've done through these centuries is to have silver as a backing, as a storehouse of wealth. So pick up the story from there.
Okay, well, one of the interesting facts about India and the jewelry market is that it's traditional for many centuries for the women to wear silver jewelry. And what's interesting about it is if they need to sell that jewelry because of economic hard times or a family crisis or something like that, that jewelry will not be sold direct as jewelry. There's a big superstition in India not to ever buy any secondhand silver. So it's sold to the silversmith, who then melts it down and remakes it into another form, which is normally jewelry or something else. But I thought it was kind of interesting. I just discovered that fact recently. Most of the silver and gold, by the way, India is the world's largest consumer of gold and silver, and it's probably almost always internal. In other words, the market, the silver market and gold both, do have sell-offs from time to time when valued in rupees, it looks like it's, you know, they're making a profit, so to speak. They might sell some off. But most of that's internal. In other words, that gold and silver doesn't come back outside of India. And most of it, I mean, a little bit does, but for the lion's share of it, and for all practical purposes, it all stays internal in the country.
All right. Then, of course, India consumes an awful lot of the silver that's produced throughout the world.
That's right. And Indian jewelry, for example, it's all much less than sterling. It's either, some of it's 50%, a lot of it is about 70%, and the highest end is 85%. None of them use silver higher than 85%. Now, they do make some sterling, which is 92.5% for export, and there is a little bit of silver jewelry exported at the sterling classification. But as far as internal in India, it's actually diluted to at least 85%, sometimes 75%.
Okay, fine. So, of course, then this is one of the places it's used. What about in China? Is silver popular with the 1.25 billion people in communist China?
Well, that's a tough one, Stan. It's always the China mystery, and I'm glad you gave me the question because I don't mind hard questions. Let me give you some history first. China at one time was valued silver higher than anybody else in the world. And there was a trade going on between Europe and China because you could actually make a profit with your gold selling, trading between silver and gold between Europe and China. So the Chinese were valued silver higher than anybody else, so there was an arbitrage going on between gold and silver, and that allowed the Chinese to amass a great amount of silver. Now, that's history. Current day, China imported silver until 1997. From 1997 onward, they've been a net exporter of silver. And the big, one of the big silver bearer arguments is that China has a great deal of silver, and they are going to keep exporting the silver, and that's dampening the market. And to be truthful, it has had an effect on the silver market. They have exported silver, and it has pretty much put a lid on the price for some time now. It's not totally China, though. The facts, though, if you go behind it, are a little more interesting. What really is happening is that the net amount coming out of China is not as great as the amount that's reported. Now, the reported amount is accurate. What is not told, or the whole story, as Paul Harvey would say, is the fact that most of this silver is from smelting that's done internal in China. For example, most of the smelting capacity is in China these days, not in North America. So what happens is polymetallic miners that mine lead, zinc, copper, molybdenum, rhodium, whatever, send it into China, it's smelted out, silver comes out as a byproduct, and that's the silver that's being shipped out.
But I think it's just important to mention, David, is the reason it's sent to China is because all of these crazy environmental rules and regulations that we have do not apply in China, so they can go ahead and smelt it over there, we can't smelt it here. And here's just with another major industry we've shipped offshore because, of course, of the environmentalists who are being funded by people like Ted Turner and Ben and Jerry's and our major corporations and, yes, our major tax-exempt foundations. We've created one of the best enemies, eternal enemies, our own money can buy. We'll be right back here in just a moment with David Morgan. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is, of course, David Morgan, and we're talking about what's happening in the silver market. And, of course, David's got a tremendous wealth of information, and he's been pointing out, of course, that China is doing a lot of smelting for countries throughout the world. And let's see who we have on the line here. Who's calling in?
It's Mike.
Hi, Mike. Do you have a question or comment?
Two questions. One about silver, and if you don't mind my using the word hype, that we've been hearing so much about silver and you know, the price going up and it's a good investment and everything. I have an idea about the source of that hype, which is not good. And it has to do with, well, one of the words I use, a phrase regarding Kosovo, the great silver heist. I believe there's a lot of silver in Kosovo, and people knew that ahead of time, and they went after it. It's in, I think, in nickel mines. And so a number of years have gone by now since the war and since all those mines transferred ownership, and now the people who own that, whoever they may be, maybe primarily British, they've had a chance to get a certain amount of gold, of silver out, and they'll get more, and of course they want to hike the price.
All right, well, let's get David's response to that, okay? Because, David, you spent a lot of time on this. What about this idea that there was a lot of silver in the mines there in Kosovo?
Well, I defer that to one of the best studies in the world. I mean, arguably the two best studies in the world are both from Goldfield Mineral Services out of the United Kingdom. And the second one is from a CPM group of New York, New York. And both of them dispel that as a rumor. So I would go along with them. I don't have any personal knowledge. I mean, if this gentleman is, you know, witness it firsthand, we could take it as hearsay. But as far as I'm personally concerned, I would, you know, rely on the two best silver studies in the world. Neither one of them give any credibility to that.
Have you done any personal research on this? What is your source of information other than a rumor?
I wanted to say I'm not basing anything of this on hearsay. It's my own deductions based on watching world events.
Okay, but of course, you know, we've heard the same thing over and over again. Oh, the price is not going to go, you know, is not going to go up because, you know, we're doing it where there's not going to be any demand for photography. And so we're always being manipulated by one group or another. And I can remember back in the early 1970s saying the price of these products are not going to go up. They will never go up. And then we saw the great run. Well, what's your second point, Mike?
Well, just back to the first one. Like I said, I haven't heard any such rumor before, but I think it's only natural that UK and New York sources, big silver people, would deny such a thing.
Well, yeah, that you have perfect right to that opinion. What's your other point?
Back to the debt. We hear so much about the national debt, but so little about who holds the debt. And I believe that's even more important than the debt itself, because that's who we will serve one day if we're not serving them already.
All right.
Who might they be?
Okay. Anything else, Mike?
That's all. Thanks.
Thanks very much. That was Mike, of course, with his thoughts. So why don't you pick up from there, David?
Okay. Well, primarily the debt is held by over 40% is held by foreign entities. So
now you're talking now of the national debt, which at the present time that they will admit, and this is about 6.5 trillion, something like that, 6.4 trillion. And of course, it's going up all the time. It'll be up by to 7 probably within a year or so. But of course, the 40% of that, at least the part, you see, there's two parts to that. One is the Social Security Medicare debt, and then the other part is the debt, of course, which is publicly held by somebody outside the government. And that, of course, is what, it's primarily what, China, Japan, and Germany?
Yes. Yes, it's mostly foreign governments that own a great deal of it. And then, of course, there's individuals within the United States and a lot of institutional ties. For example, a lot of insurance companies own a great deal of T-bills, T-notes, and T-bonds. What's interesting to note is that in monetary history, you cannot continue a debt-based monetary system indefinitely, and that's what I think we're witnessing now. So if the United States, and this I don't, it's very interesting if this would happen, defaults, which, of course, there's nothing safer than a government bond, right? But in history, that has happened. Then you will have, you know, international chaos in the financial system, and, of course, they'll try to prevent that at all costs. The way out of it is to inflate. And if you inflate your way out of it, you get into like a Weimar Republic situation, which you get hyperinflation. The capital markets are too advanced for that to happen, in my view, and there's too much of a feedback mechanism because the four traders in the bond market are arguably the smartest traders in all the commodities. And they'll see this happening, and because of that, they'll make the credit yields widen. In other words, the best debt or the most likely to be paid back will have a premium that's low, and the most unworthy credit will get a very large risk premium built into it. For example, a corporate bond that is very marginal at best might have a very high interest rate, which means that the bond price goes down substantially. It's deflationary. So there's all these forces going back and forth. The government has already told us, Mr. Bernanke has said that basically they'll burn the store down. He's basically stood up and said that we have at our fingertips the printing press, and then he laughed and he meant I mean electronic, you know, electronic money, because that's the way it's really done. I did give the printing press example, which was accurate, and that is truthful, but the way it's really done in massive amounts is by a computer keyboard entry, and they have the ability to do that willy-nilly, but just to reemphasize the point, just because they have the ability to do it doesn't mean that it's going to take effect, because there are feedback mechanisms in the financial markets, and when this happens, and you are in Japan, and you're the Japanese government, and you see that you have been in a recessionary environment for over a decade, enough is enough. If you see the United States start to do that, you might decide to get your own financial house in order and start selling those bonds, those United States bonds that you hold. The way any market moves is by buying and selling. The more selling pressure is, the more the price goes down. The more buying pressure there is, the more the price goes up. If we had a great deal of selling pressure in the bond market, for example, and we're starting to witness that now, by the way, what you might see is a very strong increase in interest rates that even the Federal Reserve itself couldn't stop because the market has taken over. And that's what I expect to see in the future. In fact, in the not-too-distant future. I would say 2 years from now, things will be significantly different in the interest rates markets than they are right now.
Well, because the other thing that I think everybody ignores is the fact that all of the central banks of the world work together in secret meetings of the Bank for International Settlement. And so, really, we in many respects don't even determine our own destiny. This is certainly determined by the central banks working out of Basel, Switzerland, on the certainly the central bank, which is located there, the Bank of International Settlement. So these people really determine our economic future. They have no loyalty to America. They have only loyalty to try to preserve this world financial system, which really has been amazing. It's created tremendous prosperity throughout the world. It's all artificial prosperity, but you see the buildings going up, and you see the cranes, and you see the new industries produced. The trouble is, you see, you got all these industries throughout the world, and you don't have any place to sell the products because people don't have the money to buy them. So they've created a monster, and the only question is, how are they going to tame this monster?
Well, that's true. I mean, you have two scenarios. You have the inflationary way out of it, or you have the debt liquidating depression way out of it, which, of course, means massive defaults. And we're already witnessing a lot of that in this country. You haven't seen much in the news you know, most recently, but if you look back over the last couple of years, you have, you know, Enron, Global Crossing, you have several, like you had Sears, Sears Roebuck. I mean, that's one of the largest retailers in the country, lost one half of its market cap in one day. That means that the value of that whole company was cut in half in one trading day on the stock exchange. That is deflationary. So you are witnessing defaults. Another one that was not real recent but was very significant was long-term capital management. I mean, these guys were brilliant mathematicians that had come up with this options writing formula, and they were leveraging at this unbelievable rate. I think it was like 500 to 1, if my numbers are correct, but it was significant. And it started; these trades started to go against them. And basically, the Federal Reserve came into the mix and said, you know, we're going to stop this thing and prevent a financial meltdown. And the derivatives market is so huge now that these type of things are almost, I wouldn't say they're guaranteed, but it's very important that the American public wake up and witness the fact that this derivatives market does hold a very potential for a potential calamity. And that's just not, you know, some little David Morgan that runs SilverInvestor.com saying it. It's someone as profound and arguably the best investor in the world, Warren Buffett, that calls it toxic waste.
No,
that's how he refers to derivatives.
His remark was, of course, derivatives are a potential weapons of financial mass destruction. Currently latent, but potentially lethal. I thought that was just such a beautiful play on words. Currently latent, but potentially lethal. Financial weapons of mass destruction. Let's go to Tony calling from SoCal. Hi, Tony. How are you doing?
Oh, that was a great lead-in because I wanted to ask about Warren Buffett when he brought it up while I was on hold. In fact, I called the other day when Mr. Morgan was on your earlier show. I was asking about the Chinese and the silver leasing. And the question I wanted to ask tonight is, concerns Warren Buffett and something that happened earlier in the year. From what I understand, when Mr. Buffett purchased, I believe it was about 130 million ounces of silver back in, I believe, 98. The first part of my question is, I believe he only took possession of about 90 million ounces, and then he may have leased out the rest. And that would be about 40 million ounces. And it seems that there's only about 40 to 50 million ounces available on the COMEX that hasn't already been committed. And I was wondering if there's a possibility that maybe he might be wanting to get his lease delivered.
All right. Well, do you know anything about Mr. Buffett and what he did with his silver? I know he moved a lot of it out of the country. Why would he move it out of the country is a very big question. And then what did he do with the rest of it, and why didn't he take it all? Do you have any answers for that, David?
Well, I do. First of all, is this Tony? Is that his name?
This is Tony, right?
Yeah, Tony, are you a subscriber to my website?
No, I'd never heard of you until you were on Dr. Stan's the other day, and I called him out.
I'm just curious because you were obviously a good student of the silver market, and
I do read Ted Butler's site.
Okay, well that's fine. I mean, I've written a special report that I give away for free to new subscribers on my website.
Why don't you tell people how to get those things, David?
Okay, it's if you go to my website, silver-investor.com. There's a bunch of silver bars on the left side of the site, and you can click to subscribe to the Silver Investor Newsletter. When you hit the subscribe to the Silver Investor Newsletter, there's three ways you can subscribe. You can do it over the internet, you can phone in an order, or you can fax in an order. So, or you can actually mail an order in. So you can do it by mail, by fax, by internet, or by phone. So anyway, coming back to this question, you're a good student of the market. Basically, I wrote a report that covers more than what you just said, but you're right. The public information was that he was able to get 90 million ounces. And at that time, Mr. Buffett made the statement that he would give the dealers more time to deliver the rest. Now, more time is very vague. It's not specific. It's not 6 months, 6 years, or 600 years. It's just more. At the time, lease rates have gone over 30%. Buffett hates a stagnant investment. What that means is he doesn't like any kind of an asset class that doesn't earn interest. Well, a good way to earn interest in the silver market is by leasing it. If you have 30% interest rates and you're willing to let the dealers off the hook because they couldn't scramble to get the silver, remember silver went over $7 at the time. If there's so doggone much silver around and all he wanted was the real stuff, the real silver, not a paper piece of paper saying silver on it, why did the price go up so quickly and so high? But anyway, coming back to the point, I do believe that, and based on the annual report for Berkshire Hathaway, I have deduced, but it's not an absolute fact, but I've deduced by math that he did only have 90 million ounces and possibly lease the rest. That's what I truly believe has happened. Now, what was the second part of the question, Tony?
No, by leased, you mean he has the right to it, but he's leased out to somebody else. Is
correct.
That right?
He doesn't have it in his full possession.
All right, fine.
He can call his loan in.
Oh, right. Well, that is a little more fuzzy, and of course, I'm not an absolute on the first part. Those leases are normally written, and I'm in tune with some of the people that write these leases, although to be truthful, I've never seen one in black and white. They're written in two ways. One, they're non-callable. They're usually about 99% of them are rolled over, and Ted Butler agrees with me on that, or I agree with him, I should say. So they're settled in cash year after year, or month after month. Whenever they're due, they're settled for in cash. Now, obviously, the way the contract should be written would be callable. Now, whether or not they are is debatable. However, certainly Mr. Buffett would know how to write a contract. So in his case, I would say it probably wouldn't be the quote-unquote standard contract with a bank that would say, in the case of default, we'll just give you paper dollars and wink, wink, everybody's happy. I would imagine in Mr. Buffett's case, he's either put a huge premium on it, like pay me twice the spot price of silver, or bring the silver back guaranteed. I'm just guessing at that, but I also know I've studied Mr. Buffett, and I doubt very strongly that he wouldn't write an ironclad contract. Your deduction that you made is very interesting to me because you're very well aware of what the classifications are in the commodities exchange. The 41 million ounces that's in the COMEX in the register category is almost identical to the amount that I believe he did lease. So it is very tight. I mean, I think the only thing we can conclude for sure is that the silver market is getting tighter and tighter by the day. There is a possibility that Mr. Buffett has not collected all that he's paid for, and that if he ever did want to squeeze the market, I believe he could do it quite easily.
Well, and I think he also, of course, is very attuned to the ruling establishment that really manipulates the market. I don't think he's going to intentionally embarrass anybody right at the present time. Now, there may come a time where he will, but sometimes you're better off not to rock the boat. After all, when you're one of the richest men in the world, you wouldn't want to end up like Bunker Hunt.
Well, Dr. Stan, just considering Bunker Hunt now, now, Warren Buffett said he studied Bunker Hunt and wasn't going to make the same mistakes as he did. Now, my next question has to do with exactly this. Now, I'm not familiar with Mr. Morgan until he was on your program the other day, but I can tell he knows what he's talking about. Now, and he knows about Ted Butler. Now, Ted Butler, earlier in the year, had an article where he talked about a very strange trade that took place. That I believe is still active, and I was wondering if you knew about this because I haven't kept up on it. But somebody purchased call options, I believe for November, of 30 million ounces of silver. I believe it was right near $7 an ounce.
That's just for this year.
For this year. And why would anybody be willing to put down $10 million to purchase these options that far off at such a high price? It just seems crazy. And then, now, in fact, I was talking to my wife about this earlier today. Now, for Warren Buffett, $10 million is some change. What if, this is speculation now, what if it was Warren Buffett that did that?
Well, why don't we get that, rather than speculate, let's go ahead and get that. David, do you know anything at all about what David...
Yeah, he's right. A few very minor things that I'll clarify, and he didn't say anything really wrong. They are December options. They are this year. December options, for anybody that has never studied the option market, actually expire in November, so that's accurate. It was roughly the amount that he said, and there's lots of speculation about it. I hadn't thought of Buffett doing it, although it's certainly possible. More likely, and Ted and I have talked about this, it's somebody like Barrick, who has shorted a vast quantity of silver at the $5 level. And most technicians, and Ted's not really a technical guy. I use it more than Ted, and I'm more of a fundamentalist also. But if you look at a long-term chart of silver, it's been beaten down from the 550 level about 7 years consistently. In other words, every time it gets up to about 550, it comes back right back down. So once it gets through that barrier, and it might be able to do that before the end of this year, you will have everybody holding silver at a profit for all practical purposes. Stan, I mean, you're right with the introduction. You know, somebody probably is out there that held it, bought it at 14 and still holding it, but it didn't trade in those ranges for very long. I mean, if you look at a long-term chart, most of the silver's been around $5 the ounce or under, except for the Buffett blip in 1997. So, coming back to the 550 level, once it gets above that, silver will probably run and run strong because there's not much to hold it back after that point. So certainly, I would look at those options probably being purchased by a large entity such as a Barrick or somebody that's short, is a little bit scared about the market perhaps, maybe has, you know, very good information, and has decided that the worst case scenario is that if silver runs from them, they're only going to lose $2 an ounce. For the Barrick example, they sold short that many ounces in the futures market. It's actually in the over-the-counter market, but it's still the futures market. And they have a $2 delta. In other words, they sold it at 5. They bought the calls at 7. The worst they can do is lose $2 an ounce. It's a heck of a lot better than losing $20 an ounce. Which is obviously, you know, sounds remote now, but once the silver market really starts to move, you're going to see some interesting days ahead.
But of course, the thing is, if somebody's going to take delivery on 30 million ounces of silver, that is going to wreak havoc with the market as well, isn't it?
Yeah. So let me interject something I haven't said on your show, Stan, which I probably am a little remiss in not doing. I'll do it right now. I'm on record as having said that I truly believe that the silver market, futures market, will cease to exist in its present form within the next 3 years. And the reason I have such confidence in making that statement is two things. One, the way the price has been managed for the last 15 years, and secondly, the amount of physical silver that's available. Sooner or later, the physical market will dominate. The futures market will make no sense whatsoever. When that happens, it doesn't mean that all the silver's gone. There's nothing to really worry about. What will happen is what's happened in the egg market. Eggs used to be a futures traded commodity. They no longer are. But there's lots of eggs in the shelves. It goes to a cash market only. And a cash market is really a much more fair and just market than the futures exchanges.
What you're saying is it can't be manipulated quite as easily.
That's correct.
You know, my theory, and for what it's worth, and you can both disagree with me, but I think that everything is manipulated. I think that what they're waiting is to the point where most people really don't have any money to participate in the market or to take advantage of it. And at that point, when people are not going to have the ability to get on the train as it's beginning to roar out of the station, why, of course, then they're going to let the train roar out of the station, and the only very, very few people will be on it. And I think that we're moving probably into a deflationary cycle, contrary to what everything is being told by the controlled media. And, of course, the Federal Reserve knows this. We're going the same way that Japan has. We'll probably have a bust in the real estate market before too long. And when the real estate bubble bursts, why, of course, hang on to your hat. And only when these things happen and there's really beginning to be increasingly shortages of money, you're just not going to be able to go out and borrow it as readily as you do. I had somebody call me today. They wanted to give me a free credit card that I could borrow $20,000 on, and, of course, it would be no interest until the year 2004. Now, what they're trying desperately to do is get people to borrow money. But, of course, I believe the time is going to come when they're going to have to turn off the spigot because there's not going to be enough people there that are going to be able to pay it back. And the one thing the bank hates is the world where default on my loan to you, or bankruptcy. So we are, of course, I think, on the edge of something significant. I don't know how you, Tony, or you, David, feel about what I said.
Well, I'd like to comment. First of all, I have a quote of my own. I hope this doesn't sound egotistical, but the quote goes, when you don't have free markets, you don't have freedom. When there's no free markets, there's no freedom.
I think that's true.
And I agree with you, Stan. I think all the markets are controlled. I mean, certainly can build a very strong argument for all the commodities. I mean, the way the stock market's done, I'm pretty much on the inside track there as far as not being a manipulator myself, but I know how all the NASDAQ works, the market makers work, and how the floor of the New York works, and basically it's favorable to the Wall Street brokerage houses and not as favorable to the public.
I mean, sort of, we win, you lose.
And I also agree with the deflationary scenario. I'm one of the few that believes that, you know, show me, don't tell me. I mean, it's one of those, I forget the exact quote, you might help me, but you protest too much, Brutus. You know, they keep talking about how they're going to burn the store and overinflate, and don't worry, we can, push a button and make all the credit that we want, and we're going to do it, but they've been saying that, and we've been just, you know, one quarter away from this coming out of this recession for several quarters in a row. The evidence, the facts point to deflation right now. And the last comment is that the markets generally favor the fewest. In other words, if it was very easy to get rich in the stock market, everyone would be rich in the stock market, but they're not. You look at a lot of people that were once rich on paper that are now licking their wounds and hoping, they're going down the slope of hope that the stock market will come back. It won't come back. I mean, it's made a rally here. I predicted the rally go to 9,200 about 6 months ago. I'm on record as saying that. And I think we're topping out. If you look at what it's showing now, it's a distribution pattern. A distribution pattern is where the professionals are yah-yah-yahing the stock market and getting the public to keep buying so that they can unload their shares at a profit to the public. That's called distribution. That's what's happening right now.
Okay, Tony, any thoughts before we let you go?
Can I ask one more question?
Sure,
On silver?
Right.
Okay. The one thing that I've watched about silver the longest, I'd say maybe over the last 20 years or so, is the ratio that it sells for to gold, the gold-silver ratio.
Okay.
And at one point, I believe it was about 93, it was like it took 100 ounces of silver to buy an ounce of gold. It was up to about 100, and then it dropped down to, I believe, around 35, 38. And then it's climbed up to around 80, 85, and now it's down under 70. And myself, I happen to feel that it's going to go a lot lower, possibly even under 16 to 1, what, you know, the long-term historical, historically has been. And my question is there's a lot more gold in the world than there is silver. I mean, the silver is consumed and used and it's gone. And I know there's a lot more gold than silver. Do you see the possibility that silver could actually one day become more valuable than gold? And that's my question, and I'll listen on the air.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think first you need to get to my website and look at silver-investor.com, hit the archives button, and read an article called Engineering the Price of Gold. I go through that. Yes, silver did hit a 100-to-1 ratio twice in history. It also was a 16-to-1 ratio at the height of the market in 1980. I'm on record several places over the radio shows and published data that I believe at the height of the market this next time we'll see a 10-to-1 ratio. So if gold gets to $3,000 the ounce in paper, silver could be 300. But that's not too much to focus on. As far as getting beyond the price of gold, I do not believe that'll happen in our lifetime, but I do want to be on record as saying that Jerome Smith, who was probably the most knowledgeable of the silver market back in the late 70s, 1980s time frame, did predict that silver would trade more per ounce than gold in our lifetime. I doubt that's true. However, once silver does make it to $10 an ounce, I'm going to be watching the market as closely as I've watched it for the last 20 years. And what I want to see is how much silver comes back on the market. If we get 30, 40, 50 million ounces of silver, silver will trade for more than an ounce of gold, in my view, in my children's lifetime or their children's lifetime, no doubt about it. On the other hand, if when it hits 10, we get like 250 million ounces of silver, in other words, there's a lot more silver out there than we have been taught that there is by the best studies in the world for the last 20 years, then I would have to reevaluate. So I'm going to let the market tell me. But if there's the amount that's been published for the last 20 years and it's anywhere near accurate, I believe in Tony's children's lifetime or their children's lifetime that silver will be more valuable than gold per ounce.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. We're out of time. Our guest has been David Morgan. And, of course, if you'd like to go to his website, it's www.silver-investor.com. Telephone number, David?
877 877-610-9962. That's a toll-free number, 877-610-9962.
Thank you so much for being with us. Good night. God bless. Bye-bye. And this is Dr. Stan. Of course, this is the time when we have to say goodbye to our listeners up in the Great Northwest. And, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, and, of course, to pray for greater liberty, for our provision and our protection. And tomorrow evening, we'll have some pre-recorded programs. We'll be back with you Monday. Until then, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests. And this next hour, we're not going to have a guest, and we're not even going to take any calls until we get through with this discussion of democracies and republics. And I think it's so vitally important that our listeners understand that if you read the Constitution of the United States, if you read the Declaration of Independence, if you read the Bill of Rights, if you read the Federalist Papers, you will never want to see the use of the word democracy other than to decry it and say, we don't want a democracy, we want a republic. And there's all the difference between a republic and a democracy. They are exact opposites of the political spectrum. And the fact that our leaders, George Bush and Al Gore and so many of our people talk about democracy, returning government to the people. Well, these are wonderful, wonderful phrases. But, of course, this is not what America was all about. For our founding fathers made it very clear. They knew that the one force that took away freedom was government. And so they wanted to take the chains off of the people and put the chains on government. For that government governs best, it governs the least. They knew that liberty and limited government were synonymous and that tyranny and total government were synonymous. Now, of course, it was Thomas Jefferson who said, sometimes it's said that man cannot be trusted with the government of himself. Can he then be trusted with the government of others, or have we found angels in the forms of kings to govern him? Elsewhere, Jefferson said, in questions of power, let no more be heard of confidence in men, but bind him down from mischief by the chains of the Constitution. And that, as Plato had said, democracy passes into despotism. You'll find that quotation in Bartlett's famous quotations. And, of course, we have to understand that most people don't really understand very much about our society or how we got to where we are. Now, men have always accepted the necessity of some form of control over their lives because they wanted to avoid anarchy. And so governments were established to enact rules to protect lives and liberty and the property of the citizens. But once those basic rights were secure, that is life, liberty, and property, additional laws only restricted men's individual freedom. Our founding fathers knew that liberty and limited government were synonymous, and that tyranny and total government were synonymous, so they set out to limit all forms of government. And they knew that Certainly, there was no effective way to limit the misuse of power in a democracy, so they established a republic where men would be ruled by law rather than the will of the majority. Most people have heard of the story of the woman who approached Benjamin Franklin on September 18, 1787, as he came down the steps from the Constitution Hall where the Constitution had been written. And there was a woman named Mrs. Powell, and she said, "Well, doctor, what have we got, a republic or a monarchy?" And Benjamin Franklin replied, "A republic, if you can keep it." Do you ever wonder how that story got in the books? Well, apparently, one of the aides to Dr. Franklin was there. He overheard Mrs. Powell ask the question and recorded it in his memoirs, and you'll find that story in Bartlett's familiar quotations. Now, to grasp the significance of what Benjamin Franklin was saying, you have to understand the events that led up to the destruction of ancient Greece, Athens, and destruction of ancient Rome. Athens was a prosperous city-state until it became a democracy in 508. But at that point in 508 BC, the will of the majority became the law of the land, and the minority had absolutely no rights. The ruling oligarchy manipulated the populace and plunged Athens into a series of disastrous wars. And of course, you could always manipulate people into wars. And first they bought Persia, and then they fought the Peloponnesian Wars. And then, of course, the taxes had to go up to pay for all the military actions. And of course, certain people benefited from the wars, and others, of course, had to pay the taxes and lost their property. Class warfare eventually broke out as the poor people sought to steal the wealth of the rich through the process of democracy. Now, if you've ever been to Athens, as I have, and stood at the foot of the mound where, of course, the Parthenon is located, or stood by Mars Hill and looked up at the magnificent architecture of the Parthenon, and you realize, of course, this wonderful Greek philosophy, but a society, but it was all destroyed because, of course, the people lost confidence in the form of government, and, of course, democracy collapsed. And people will tell you, that's a different type of democracy that we have. Of course, that could never happen here. Well, you go back and read chapter 8 of Plato's Republic, and this is what he noted. Democracy, which is a charming form of government, full of variety and disorder and dispensing a sort of equality to equals and unequals alike, we know her well. At one matter does tyranny arise, that it has a democratic origin is evident. And does not tyranny spring from democracy in the same manner as democracy from oligarchy? And democracy has its own good, of which the insatiable desire brings her to dissolution. The insatiable desire of this and the neglect of other things introduces the changes in democracy which occasion the demand for tyranny. The excess of liberty, whether in states or individuals, seems only to pass into excess of slavery. And so tyranny naturally arises out of democracy, and the most aggravated form of tyranny and slavery out of the most extreme form of liberty. And you have to understand, as somebody once said, that when a liberty leads to a loss of order, then the demand for order will lead to a loss of liberty. And you're seeing this increasingly here in America today, as we see the breakdown in really the structure of our society, as we turn our back on God and the foundations which once made America the envy of the entire world. Now, of course, Alexander the Great defeated Athens in 338 BC, and that was the end of the great Greek experiment with democracy. Rome was established as a republic in 509 BC, and the senators who ruled the city were elected by popular vote. But Roman law restricted what the senators could do. As a result, the people were free and most of them prospered. But then, with the passage of time, a ruling class evolved, and they began using the Senate to pursue their expansionist agenda. And of course, it was a series of foreign wars, which enriched the oligarchy and impoverished the people. And those who acquired wealth from the wars purchased the vast tracts of land and farmed them with the slaves that they captured in battle. And the smaller farmers couldn't compete with them, and they couldn't even, of course, pay the taxes on their land. So they were forced to sell their land and to become indentured servants on the land that they once owned. Class warfare broke out. The power of the state was expanded to control the populace. The right to vote was extended to promote democracy and a quiet dissent. The oligarchy began fighting among themselves for positions of power, with had ever-increasing chaos. And of course, eventually, of course, you add the corruption of the society. And if you go back and you read Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, what were the things that destroyed the Roman Empire? Why, immorality, homosexuality, the destruction of the family, a massive welfare program, the corruption of the currency to provide all the things for the people, the inflation that went along with that. And then, of course, the abortion, of course, the killing of the unborn. So when, of course, the Huns threatened the city, there was nobody left to fight, and nobody really believed in Rome any longer. Now, it's very interesting. What most people have forgotten is that the Roman Empire was split into two parts under Diocletian, about 300, a little after 300 A.D., and in the eastern half of the Roman Empire, which we refer to as the Byzantine area, was actually out of Constantinople. Why, of course, they maintained a solid currency. They did not go into democracy, but they had a stable government until well into the 1200s, when they were eventually overrun by the Muslims. But they lasted 800 years beyond the western branch of the Roman Empire, because, of course, Rome corrupted its currency, became a democracy. Then, of course, it was they allowed people to vote, but you really had, of course, the dictator, the czar, the Caesar, and of course, the great tragedy was that the people lost their freedom. The world was plunged into, of course, what they call the Dark Ages of feudalism. Now, if you read the article on democracy in the Encyclopedia Americana, here's what it says. Democracy is one of the most controversial of concepts. Not only does it have powerful enemies, but even its friends do not always agree about what they're defending. Beyond the common idea that democracy is the popular control of government, there's no universal, except the definition and the concept is complicated by various secondary meanings, common after the Industrial Revolution, such as social and economic democracy, and democracy as the ideal or total way of life. However, if you read our Constitution and our Declaration of Independence and our Bill of Rights and the Federalist Papers and the Constitution of any of our states up to 1950, you will never once see the word democracy used, other than to decry that form of government and declare that our nation is a republic. In their books, American Mid-Passage, historians Charles Austin Beard and his wife Mary wrote this, "At no time, at no place, in solemn convention assembled, through no chosen agents, had the American people officially proclaimed the United States to be a democracy. The Constitution did not contain the word or any word lending countenance to it, except possibly the mention of we the people in the preamble. When the Constitution was framed, no respectable person called himself or herself a Democrat." What is true that most people, why do most people believe we're a democracy today? Because there's been a well-financed, orchestrated effort to convince the American people that our elected officials can do whatever they want as long as the majority of them agree on a course of action. That's just the opposite of the intent of our founding fathers. They believed in the rule of law and hoped to prevent future generations from voting themselves into slavery. That's why they created a republic and made it very difficult to amend our Constitution, and why they'd be horrified at what our Supreme Court justices are doing now, because, of course, they're the third branch of the legislature. They're simply passing laws, and, of course, the other two branches don't have the courage to say anything at all about it. Over 200 years ago, Professor Alexander Tyler explained why democracies fail, and this is what he wrote. "A democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until a majority of the voters discover they can vote themselves largesse from the public treasury, and from that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidate who promises the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that a democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy, always followed by a dictatorship." It was known over 200 years ago that democracies failed. That, well, who is it who is coordinating this effort to convince us that we're a democracy? We are the people of great wealth. Because they realize that when all power has been centralized with the federal government, and of course the laws are passed by politicians, they can buy and sell the politicians. Why, everyone knows we have the finest politicians in Sacramento and in Washington, D.C. that money can buy. That's why they wanted a democracy, so the elite could reestablish their rule once again. Down through the ages, why democracies have always become dictatorships. Let me give you several examples. Germany established a dictatorship after democracy was established after World War I. Chaos broke out after World War I, looting, rioting in the streets, widespread unemployment, a sense of hopelessness gripped the nation, and the German people began looking for someone who could restore law and order. Adolf Hitler was elected democratically to office in 1932, and in 1933, von Hindenburg appointed him Chancellor of Germany, and the rest is history. Most people have forgotten that the Italian people elected Benito Mussolini democratically in 1922. Following World War II, Czechoslovakia elected members of both the Socialist and the Communist parties to the legislature, and when the Socialists walked out to force new elections, the Communists just established a democratic dictatorship, but it was done legally through the democratic process. The American State Department often intervenes in democratic elections held in other countries. If the a candidate that we favor, that we want in power, isn't elected, we apply economic pressure until the populace agrees to elect him. That happened in Rhodesia over 20 years ago when we brought the communist Mugabe to power and we installed the current Marxist regime in South Africa, the current communist regime in Southwest Africa, the current communist regime in Angola, and of course they're largely funded by Chevron money. In fact, there was a freighter that used to go in and out of the port of Angola. It was called the Condoleezza Rice. It was an oil tanker. And then, of course, it disappeared at sea one time. Well, it sailed out of the port as the Condoleezza Rice and sailed back with another name because they didn't want the American people to realize that the head of our National Security Committee, the foreign policy advisor to the President of the United States, was so closely aligned with the oil companies. So there's so much that the American people really aren't supposed to know. And, of course, in 1928, the Army Training Manual defined democracy this way. A government of the masses, authority derived through mass meetings or any other form of direct expression, results in mobocracy. Attitude towards property is communistic, negating property rights. Attitudes towards the law is that the will of the majority shall regulate, whether it be based upon deliberation or governed by passion, prejudice, and impulse, without restraint or regard to consequences, results in a demagogism, license, agitation, discontent, and anarchy. That was the U.S. training manual in 1928, and President Roosevelt had all of those training manuals collected and destroyed because, of course, they didn't want the American people to understand that democracy always leads to tyranny. Democracy has been defined as two wolves negotiating with a sheep on what they're going to have for dinner, whereas a republic has been said to be two wolves negotiating with a sheep, but there are laws against eating sheep, and of course the sheep is armed, heavily armed. James Madison was our fourth paper president, and he wrote this, "Democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention, have ever been found incompatible with personal security or the rights of property, and have in general been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths." Alexander Hamilton wrote this, "It has been observed that a pure democracy, if it were practicable, would be the most perfect government. But experience has proved that no position is more false than this. The ancient democracies in which the people themselves deliberated never possessed one good feature of government. Their very character was tyranny, their figure, deformity." Now, our founding fathers all knew this. Our founding fathers were well-educated. They hadn't been systematically dumbed down. They'd been taught with phonics. They'd been taught classical history. They knew what had happened in Greece and Rome. They knew what had happened in other nations, and they knew you couldn't trust men because they believed in the Bible that men were basically corrupt, and you gave them power, power would be misused. And as Lord Acton wrote, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And as, of course, has been added to that, absolute power corrupts absolutely everyone. John Adams, the second president of the United States, warned, "Remember, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There never was a democracy yet that did not commit suicide." And later, John Adams wrote this, "Democracy will soon degenerate into an anarchy, such an anarchy that every man will do what is right in his own eyes, and no man's life or property or reputation or liberty will be secure. And every one of these will soon mold itself into a system of subordination of all the moral virtues and intellectual abilities, all the powers of wealth, beauty, wit, and science to the wanton pleasures, to the capricious will, to the execrable cruelty of one over a very few." Thomas Jefferson in 1790 wrote a letter to William Hunter in which he stated, "The Republican is the only form of government which is not eternally open at open or secret war for the rights of mankind. The Republican is the only form of government which is not eternally at open or secret war for the rights of mankind." And then in his first inauguration address, Thomas Jefferson proclaimed, "Sometimes it is said that man cannot be trusted with the government of himself. Can he then be trusted with the government of others, or have we found angels in the form of kings to govern him? Let history answer this question." Later, Thomas Jefferson described the type of government we should have, a wise and frugal government, which will restrain men from injuring one another, which will leave them otherwise free to regulate their own pursuits of industry and improvement, and shall not take from the mouth of labor the bread it has earned. This is the sum of good government. Fisher Ames, who wrote our Constitution, warned that democracy is a volcano which conceals the fiery material of its own destruction. These will produce an eruption and carry desolation in their way. The known propensity of a democracy is to licentiousness, while the ambitious call ignorant to believe to be liberty. A democracy is a volcano which conceals the fiery material of its own destruction. These will produce an eruption and carry desolation in their way. The known propensity of a democracy is to licentiousness, which the ambitious call and the ignorant believe to be liberty. Governor Morris, who signed our Constitution and wrote it, said, "We have seen the tumult of democracy terminate, as it has everywhere terminated in despotism." John Quincy Adams, the sixth president of the United States, proclaimed, "The experience of all former ages has shown that of all human governments, democracy was the most unstable, fluctuating, and short-lived." Benjamin Rush signed the Declaration of Independence, and he wrote, "A simple democracy is one of the greatest of evils." John Witherspoon, who signed the Declaration of Independence, said, "Pure democracy cannot subsist long, nor be carried far into the Department of State. It is very subject to caprice and the madness of popular rage." Noah Webster, who wrote Webster's Dictionary, warned, "In a democracy, there are commonly tumults and disorders. Therefore, pure democracy is generally a very bad form of government. It is often the most tyrannical government on earth." Oscar Wilde, of all people, wrote this, "Democracy means simply the bludgeoning of the people, by the people, and for the people." Lord Acton noted, "The one pervading evil of democracy is the tyranny of the majority, or rather of that party, not always the majority, that succeeds by force or fraud in carrying the election." What's the difference between a republic and a democracy? In a democracy, elected officials can pass any sort of legislation they desire as long as the majority of the elected officials agree. In a republic, elected officials are restricted in what they can do. A democracy is ruled by man, a republic is ruled by law. The opening phrase of the First Amendment to our Constitution proclaims, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." The Bill of Rights was designed to limit the authority of Congress, of the federal government. The First 8 Amendments limited the acts of Congress in respect to our personal freedom, and Amendments 9 and 10 limited the acts of Congress to the issues cited in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. Thus, most of what Congress has done in recent years has been both illegal and unconstitutional. Thomas Jefferson addressed that subject when he wrote, "The several states composing the United States of America are not united on the principle of unlimited submission to their general government, delegating to that government certain definite powers, reserving each state to itself the residuary mass of rights of their own self-government. At that whensoever the general government assumes undelegated powers, its acts are unauthoritative, void, and of no force. The Constitution of the United States, having delegated to Congress a power to punish treason, counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the United States, piracies and felonies committed on the high seas, and offenses against the laws of nations, and no other crime whatsoever. And it being true as a general principle that one of the amendments of the Constitution having so declared that the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Therefore, the power to create, define, and punish such other crimes is reserved and of right pertains solely and exclusively to the respective state, each within its own territory. Confidence is everywhere the parent of despotism. Confidence is everywhere the parent of despotism. Free government is founded in jealousy and not in confidence. It is a jealousy and not confidence which prescribes limited constitutions to bind down those whom we are obliged to trust with power. That our constitution has accordingly fixed the limits to which our confidence may go. Let the honest advocate of confidence read the Alien and Sedition Acts and say if the Constitution has not been wise in fixing limits to the government it created. In questions of power, let no more be heard of confidence in men, but bind him down for mischief by the chains of the Constitution. And that, ladies and gentlemen, that's what it's all about. We were formed as a republic so that the power of the central authority would be limited, and of course matters dealing with life, liberty, and property would be dealt with at the state and the local level, not where the federal government would prescribe the curriculum that was to be used in our local schools, not where the federal government would form a Gestapo that would, of course, regulate every aspect of our society, not where the federal government would set up something like DARPA to collect files on every individual, not with a FBI that would no longer simply be investigating, but would be actually laying traps for American citizens and luring them into violating the laws so they could either manipulate them or arrest them or kill them as they did at Waco. You know, we have real problems in America today because we've forgotten what a republic was all about. And, of course, gradually, because of the degree of control that exists over the media and over our educational system, over our institutions of learning, and, of course, over our textbooks, they have actually, by repetition, over and over and over again, repeating our democracy, they've made people believe something that just isn't true. But you have to understand that the great tax-exempt foundations, Rockefeller and Ford and Carnegie, took over control of our textbook production, took over certainly our Encyclopedia Britannica, publishing that, in the mid-1950s. And any of you have any doubt of that, need to get the book we've republished called Foundations, Their Power and Influence. It was based upon the only congressional investigation ever allowed of the great tax-exempt foundations of the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, and all the other great foundations at that time, which were interested in not in changing America. Not of passing on the traditions of America, but of transforming America from a free society into a socialist society, into a feudalistic society, under the control of a ruling elite. And behind that were, of course, the dark spirits of forces that energized the Rockefeller family and the Ford family and Andrew Carnegie and his descendants. And that's what you're not learning about. That's what our ministers aren't telling us about, our churches, our Christian leaders. I mean, certainly they know, some of them at least do, why the Supreme Court took God and prayer out of our schools, but they're never going to tell you that. I mean, they know that there was a secret society that took over control of the Supreme Court in 1941 and held it until 1971, and that secret society was the Masons. And it's all covered in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. Why doesn't anybody ever tell us that? And, of course, who is it that the Masons worship? Why, their emblem, you'll see it on the back of the dollar bill. Of course, it wasn't simply the emblem of Masons. That's the emblem of the ancient secret societies of which modern-day Masonry is simply a manifestation. And you see that the eye above the top of the pyramid, the glorified eye, and above that the caption, "In God We Trust." That's the God that they're talking about, not the God of the Bible, certainly, but the God of the ancient mystery religions. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, if you're concerned about what's happening to our country, if you think that the difference between a democracy and a republic is really important, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, because this is one of the most important issues facing America today. How could you convince an entire nation that we are a democracy when we're really a republic? Well, it's been said it doesn't matter how ridiculous something is. If you say it often enough and convincingly enough, and everybody says it, people will believe. And when you hear George Bush talk about our democracy, when you hear Al Gore talk about our democracy, when you hear the leaders of Congress and the Senate talk about our democracy, and Barbara Walters and Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw and everybody on the media, and nobody ever gets up and explains what I've just told you the history of these concepts, and how democracies are only temporary forms of government, and the people who are pushing the democracy know that. That's why today they know that there's going to be increasing civilian unrest. That's why they already are establishing relocation camps, and FEMA is putting out $4 or $5 billion for relocation camps. My wife talked to a gentleman the other day, and he was saying that, of course, his wife works at a plant where they do canning. And, of course, they can the various fruits here in California, but, of course, they can't, of course, compete with the canned goods that are coming in from other countries. So all the canning that they're producing is being sold to the United States government. What are they going to do with all those cans? Well, I believe, of course, they're laying in food supplies, and they're going to actually have relocation camps. Now, whether this will be because of civilian unrest or because of managed terrorist attack, like of course, the anthrax attack, certainly they knew it was coming. At least Vice President Cheney had a pretty good idea it was coming, because he and his House staff went on Cipro the very night of the September 11th attack. If they knew there was going to be an anthrax attack, and the only reason to take Cipro, which is a potentially dangerous antibiotic, is due to anthrax prophylactics, if they even suspected there was going to be a terrorist attack using anthrax, don't you think they had an obligation to let the American people know that? To let the FBI know that, to let FEMA know that, so that other people could prepare themselves? But of course they didn't. We'll be back here in just a moment and welcome your calls at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, Dr. Stan here, and the subject for this program was democracies and republics. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. And, of course, we'd love to, of course, get your thoughts on what we've been talking about. Or, of course, we can, of course, go on and tell you what Manly P. Hall wrote about the men who are bound by secret oaths to labor in the cause of world democracy. Well, I don't see any calls coming in. I hope you'll call us. But if not, why, let me tell you that in Manly P. Hall's book, The Secret Destiny of America. Now, who is Manly P. Hall? Why, he was one of the most evil men of all time. When he died, the Scottish Rite magazine said of him, he was the greatest Masonic philosopher of all time. He was a Satanist. And if you read his book, The Lost Keys of Freemason, he will tell you that when the Mason on the block has finally found the secret of his craft, at that point he will have the seething energies of Lucifer in his hands. And he openly talks about Masonry and this comes from a book entitled The Lectures in Ancient Philosophy, but he tells us that Masonry is a fraternity within a fraternity, and out of fraternity, a sort of a cover fraternity of good-hearted men who having a good time, and you know, they like to do good and entertain, but there's an inner fraternity. There's an inner fraternity that studies the secret and the secret of secrets. He refers to them as the Ancorum and the Anconorum, but it's really, of course, the mystery that has been passed down since the beginning of time. Indeed, it was whispered in the Garden of Eden in the first days of creation beneath the branches of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It was whispered by a serpent who said, ye can be as gods. Well, here's what Manly P. Hall wrote in his treatise on the secret destiny of America. Men bound by a secret oath to labor in the cause of world democracy decided that in the American colonies they would plant the roots of a new way of life. Brotherhoods were established to meet secretly, and they quietly and industriously conditioned America to its destiny for leadership in the world. And, of course, he's talking about the men who were sent over here in the 1640s by Francis Bacon. They were Rosicrucians. They were part of a secret blood brotherhood, of course, and they've always been here ever since then. And, of course, the tragedy is most people do not aware of this because of the degree of control that today exists over what the American people think. Carl Sandburg wrote, "The Republic is a dream. Nothing happens unless first a dream." And the Republic was a dream because America really was the hope of the world. It was the lighthouse on the hill. It was the one country that could lead the rest of the world to freedom. And today, of course, it's leading it to tyranny. The Republic was not established by cowards, and cowards will not preserve it, said Elmer Davis. And President John Adams said, our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It's wholly inadequate for the government of any other. And, of course, another unknown author said, freedom is not the ability to do whatever you want to do. It's the ability to do what you should do according to God's law. Thomas Jefferson wrote, the Republican is the only form of government which is not eternally at open or secret war over the rights of mankind. And, of course, Manly P. Hall, writing in his book, The Secret Destiny of America, and, of course, this is aimed at Satanists all across America. For more than 3,000 years, secret societies have labored to create the background of knowledge necessary to the establishment of an enlightened democracy among the nations of the world. And what, of course, is our president advocating? We're going to bring democracy to Iraq. Why doesn't he establish a republic over there where people can be free? Why is it, of course, that we're going in there and, of course, all we're doing is antagonizing not only the people of Iraq, but the people throughout the world? Why, of course, this is in preparation for this great new class of civilizations as we drive the Muslims throughout the world into the waiting arms of Osama bin Laden, who was a CIA agent, worked with the CIA all during the 1980s, who was meeting, at least according to the magazine Le Figaro, the French magazine will be glad to send you copies of the article, and between July 4th and July 14th of the year 2001, just 2 months before the September 11th attack. Why, of course, Osama bin Laden was in the American hospital in Dubai meeting with the CIA agent. Of course, this was well known throughout Europe, but the American people, so gullible, they really don't understand how this whole situation has been contrived, of course, to justify the Office of Homeland Security, Patriot Act 1, Patriot Act 2, the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, the DARPA, where, of course, they're creating files on everybody listening to the program tonight. We've got Howard calling from Texas. Hi, Howard. How are you doing?
Just fine, Dr. Stan. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you just fine. Good to have you with us. What part of Texas are you from?
Greenville. It's close to Dallas.
Okay, fine. Good to hear from you.
I just want to express my appreciation for the things that you're covering and saying, and this Dark Forces. I was reading today in the SCP newsletter, Lee Penn writing an article. He makes a sad commentary on this postmodern age that we have come to idolize not Christ, not put Christ up as the head, but Faust, or a Faustian type of idealization where people are hedonistic, pleasure-seeking. He concludes with a quote where he says, we live in a Faustian or Mephistophelian age, in this postmodern age. It's a sad commentary, but I'm afraid that's where people have come to largely, even in churches. Is that true?
You're absolutely right. Now, for SCP is a spiritual counterfeit project.
Yes.
And, of course, that is put out by a very good friend of ours. And he does a great job. I don't know if you've ever read his books on the New World Order.
Yes, I have.
And, of course, he was deeply involved in the occult. And of course, his book "Story About Sai Baba" was another book we carry. We recommend his material; it's excellent. He's one of the. I mean, there are perhaps maybe a dozen people around the country who really understand what's going on.
Yes, and most of his people and his writers and all are people from Ivy League universities, and they are people that consider themselves highly intelligent should listen to. I think.
Right, and of course he appeals to a certain type of people, a reader, and he does a great job, and we certainly commend his work, and we work as closely as we can. We have him a guest as our program, not infrequently.
I'm sorry?
We have him on as often as we can.
Oh, yes. Right. Yes, I've heard him on your program. Well, I just wanted to say, I think should be written and spoken about this as you do. The fact that people largely are turning toward the darkness to get their all wants met, you might say, and they're turning away from the principles of Christ.
Well, you know, it's said that the most commonly visited sites on the Internet today are the pornography sites. When we find that by an overwhelming majority, the Episcopalian Church is, saying, well, it's perfectly all right to be a homosexual,
Yes.
We don't look to the Scriptures as the source of our inspiration. We look to the Holy Spirit, and what the Holy Spirit tells us, it's all right. Well, I believe they're hearing from a spirit, but it's not the Holy Spirit.
Absolutely.
And, of course, what people don't really understand is there really are demonic forces in the world today.
Yes.
There are people who've given their lives to the devil.
Yes.
And during the Clinton administration, there were, and I've heard this at least from a woman who told me that she had all the information on the Witches' Coven that was meeting in the White House when Bill Clinton was in the White House. And she was told, though, by a friend that if she ever wrote that book, she would, of course, be killed. Well, we do know, of course, that Hillary was bringing in Jean Houston to conjure up the spirits of Eleanor Roosevelt and Mohandas Gandhi, and everybody thought that was funny.
Yes.
Everybody thought it was funny that that Nancy Reagan, of course, was going to her astrologer to get instructions on running the Republican administration with Ronald Reagan. Nobody ever put two and two together and realized that we're talking about demonic forces operating out of the White House. Ronald Reagan accepted the 33rd degree of Masonry when he was in the White House. Nobody wants to talk about that except the Masons who brag about it.
Absolutely. That's right. And notice in communicating with people on a mystery club news group, there are mystery writers on there, that there's such a tendency to call themselves pagan, and many of them are admittedly Wicca, witchcraft, and you tell them that they are communicating with Satan and his legions, and they tend to mock that, but I think underneath they probably realize that that's true.
Well, all we can do is do our best. We're called to tell the truth, and whether people want to accept it or not will be their decision. But, of course, if we don't tell them, their blood is on our hands. If we do tell them and they ignore it, their blood is on their hands. That comes from Ezekiel 3 and Ezekiel 33, and we look upon ourselves as a watchman on the wall.
Yes, that's right, Dr. Stan. Okay, well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you so very much, Howard. It's good to have you with us.
All right.
God bless. Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan. If you're out there, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. And, of course, we need your help to reach others. And what you can do, if you're out in the listening audience, just make it a point to tell 5 people every day, either about our radio programs or about our website. And if we can get even one of those people listening, and maybe one person every other day will start listening, but if they will begin telling people and they will tell people, and that's your job. As we expand the number of people who are listening to our program, we're going to have more and more and more influence. And that's why we need your help. And we hope many of you will decide you're going to join us in this epic struggle to determine if this nation or any nation conceived under God can long endure, or she'll simply perish from the earth. And, you know, you remember those words of Thomas Jefferson when he said, you know, God, who gave us life, gave us liberty. But can the liberties of a nation be secure when conviction has been forgotten that liberty is the gift of God? I tremble for my country when I realize that God is just, and his justice cannot sleep forever. Well, you know, in a democracy, laws can be changed at any time by a vote of the majority of the people. And under those circumstances, no man's life or liberty or property or security. Democracies have been likened to 3 wolves sitting down with a sheep to vote on what they're going to eat for dinner. And of course, we have to get people to understand that a lynch mob is a perfect example of a democracy. And there's usually only one vote, and he's the guy at the end of the rope. Pontius Pilate, you know, of course, went to the crowd and said, what shall I do with this man? I find no guilt in him, but the democracy, because, of course, it was a democratic decision. The crowd, who had been influenced by the agents of the Pharisees, took up the cry of crucify him, crucify him. And, of course, crowds can be influenced so readily by, of course, false prophets, by false teachers. Let's go to Mike, who's calling. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Yeah, back to your John Adams quote.
Okay.
Could you give that one again?
No, which John Adams? This is John Quincy Adams or John Adams?
And John Adams. The Constitution is wholly inadequate for, with the rest
fine.
Of it.
Well, basically what John Adams said was, remember, democracies never last long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. there never was a democracy yet that did not commit suicide. And then, of course, he also said, democracies will soon degenerate into an anarchy, such an anarchy that every man will do what is right in his own eyes, and no man's life or property or reputation or liberty will be secure, and every one of these will soon mold itself into a system of subordination of all the moral virtues and intellectual abilities, all the powers of wealth, beauty, wit, and science, to the wanton pleasures and capricious wealth, and the execrable cruelty of the one over a few. Now, of course, another point, of course, he had talked about our form of government was made for a moral and religious people, and would not suffice for any other, but I didn't quote that in this specific treatise.
Well, yeah, okay, but he said the Constitution was wholly inadequate for those who would not follow God. Loose paraphrase?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what he said. In fact, I can give it to you if you want to give me about 30 seconds. If I
could sit here
and find a book, I have it readily available.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Well, my point is that simply the Constitution is wholly inadequate for America today.
Well, that's just because it's been misinterpreted. It's not because the Constitution has failed, but because we failed the Constitution.
That's what I mean, that America, that the populace at large, is not suitable for the Constitution.
Well, we need a moral and religious people, and we need, Chris, what we're really trying to do, Mike, is re-educate the people about our Christian heritage, about the things we talk about here through the Institutes of the Constitution. We're setting these up all across America, and I'm guardedly optimistic as more and more people, of course, begin understanding what's going on. But here's what John Adams said. We have no government armed with power, capable of contending with human passion, unbridled by morality and religion. Our Constitution was made only for moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other, and we are no longer a moral and religious people, nor do we have moral and religious leaders. We have a lot of people who have a lot of platitudes, and they're so wound up in theology, they've lost sight of what Christianity is all about.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And we, as a nation, have depended over the years upon the churches for that morality and that orientation towards God. And the churches have abandoned that, and a lot of that comes from the seeker-sensitive movement.
Now, you're certainly right, and the seeker-sensitive movement is one of the worst things that ever happened, and Peter Drucker, and of course getting to Saddleback Church and Willow Creek Church. This is taking over so many of our good churches, and the trouble is, the average churchgoer who loves the Lord has no idea what's happening, as little bit by little bit, the message and the music of the church gradually change.
The churches can teach a lot of great things, and they still do, even in the seeker-sensitive churches. But once they take out, really, the strong preaching of Jesus Christ, Him crucified and resurrected, the blood of Christ, once that's taken out, the essentials that lead each individual in the churches to a deep, personal, abiding relationship with Jesus Christ, then the churches fall. That's the core of Christianity. And they can keep everything else. It's only a shell. There's a large body of teaching that remains, and it's very seductive. It leads people to believe that the church is good, the church can lead them properly, the church can lead them into a good life. In many ways, that's true. There are so many things that are taught that really can't be disputed. The teachings are so often very good and even biblically based, but the essence and the core of Christianity has been robbed from the churches through the seeker-sensitive movement. I've seen it here in Santa Cruz, and it's been going on in tens of thousands of churches across the United States. That's the only thing that matters in the church, is that deep and abiding relationship with Jesus Christ. There's nothing else that really makes a difference. Everything else is only a shell, and people are buying a shell when they go for it.
Well, they're looking for the experiences. They're looking for feeling good. A lot of this comes from Robert Schuller, who is, of course, one of the major forces behind Rick Warren and the others in the seeker-sensitive movement. And the whole idea, as he once said, I would never tell anybody they were a sinner. And yet, of course, that was the very crux of the reason Jesus Christ came to earth is because we were all sinners and we needed a Savior, or we would be doomed to eternal punishment. And that's why he came to earth. And if there is no, of course, eternal punishment, there is no reason for Jesus Christ to have come to earth. For God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth upon him should not perish, but have everlasting life.
Yes.
Well, now, we've sort of gotten away from that.
Yeah. The seeker-sensitive churches even use those words, but they do nothing to lead the individuals in the congregations into that relationship that they need. And this is nothing less than the most demonic of perpetrations on the populace of the world.
Okay, well, you're absolutely right. We have a four-tape set on the apostate church if you'd like to get into what Mike is saying, but he's absolutely right.
Take it a step further. The apostate church is nothing less than the whore of Babylon in Revelation.
Okay. Thanks so much, Mike. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
That's all, thanks.
Okay, bye-bye. God bless you. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, if you agree or disagree, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But apropos of what Mike was saying, you know, society is ordinarily a reflection of the church. Society certainly looks to the church for moral guidance. And look what's happening in our churches today. I mean, how many people have had a whole sermon pointing out, of course, what homosexuality is? And we say we're all sinners. Yes, we are all sinners, but God singled out homosexuality as certainly one of the worst sins. And, of course, he talked about it time after time in Romans and certainly in the Old Testament, both Old Testament and the New Testament. And they say, oh, they don't mention the word homosexuality. No, but they mention exactly what they do. And they knew exactly this. They use sophistry to justify this. And what people do not understand is that the agents of Satan infiltrated our seminaries many years ago and gradually began to change the teaching of our ministers. So we have a lot of good men who've gone through seminaries and have come out totally confused about the message of the gospel. We certainly have seen this in the Catholic Church, where actually they encouraged homosexuality, and of course this is bringing on the total destruction of the Catholic Church. But of course the Episcopalian Church is following close behind. Right now they're talking about a split in the Episcopalian Church. 60% of the bishops, of course, went along with ordaining the gay priest. Why? Because the Holy Spirit told them it was all right. Because, of course, they didn't look to the Scriptures as the source of their authority. They looked to the Holy Spirit. And what did the Holy Spirit tell them? Why, the Spirit whispers in their ear, it's all right to be homosexual. It's all right to be involved in fisting and all the things that are involved with a homosexual lifestyle. This is perfectly all right. This is what I want. This is what I approve. And that is not the Holy Spirit of the Bible. That is not the Holy Spirit who's part of the Trinity. That is the Holy Spirit who is part of the demonic realm. And people don't like to talk about the demonic realm, but it's real. And just as there is a Trinity of good, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, so there is a Trinity of evil. It's Satan and the Antichrist and the false prophet. And the disciples of the false prophet are the demons that inhabit the earth today. And if you haven't, of course, gone into the spiritual battle, you really need to understand that this is not imaginary. It's very real. We see the manifestations. We see them in UFOs. We see them in many of the supernatural manifestations today. We see them in the writings of many of the New Age writers who openly tell you that they embrace Lucifer and that people are going through Luciferian initiations today. We see it in the disappearance of children all across America being used in satanic sacrifices. Those of you who haven't, of course, read Malachi Martin's book, The Windswept House, about the satanic sacrifice feigned in the Vatican, but of course sacrifice, human sacrifice in the basement of the Vatican was actually carried out in real life elsewhere, and they were in contact there by telephone. But, of course, they wanted to do it in the Vatican as the ultimate affront to God. And, of course, I talked to Malachi Martin off the air, and I said, Malachi, does this sort of thing really go on? He said, absolutely, and his beautiful Irish brogue. And he talked about, of course, I think it was Pope Paul VI, who said that the smoke of Satan circulates over the top or squirrels over the top of the Vatican. Now, this is not to condemn the Catholics. Catholics that believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ is to point out that both major branches of Christendom have been infiltrated, and there are a lot of things I disagree with the Catholic Church. There's a lot of things I disagree with the Protestant Church. And the important thing is to get back to the elements and the fundamentals of Christianity, upon which we all agree, and that is in the virgin birth, and of course the death and resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ, which is, of course, what we're called upon is to believe upon him, that we may not perish and have everlasting life. Well, if you're out there and you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. So if not, why, we don't see anybody coming in, so let's go on a little bit more with this discussion of course, what this is all about. And, of course, the whole idea of a republic was something that was unique. And we were saying before that Pontius Pilate had gone to the people there in Jerusalem and said, dealing with Jesus, what shall I do with this man? And they said, crucify him. You see, the majority said, crucify him. It was the democratic thing to do. And, of course, you remember the caption there in the New Testament. Now at that feast, the governor was wont to release unto the people a prisoner whom they would, and that he had then a notable prisoner called Barabbas. Therefore, when they were gathered together, Pilate said unto them, whom shall ye that I release unto you, Barabbas or Jesus, which is called the Christ? For he knew that for envy they had delivered him. He's speaking now of the Pharisees, the Sadducees. When he was set down on the judgment seat, his wife sent unto him, saying, Have thou nothing to do with this just man, for I have suffered many things this day in a dream because of him. But the chief priests and the elders persuaded the multitude that they should ask Barabbas and destroy Jesus. And the governor answered and said unto them, whither of the twain shall ye that I release unto you? And they said, Barabbas. Pilate saith unto them, what shall I do with Jesus, which is called Christ? And they all say unto him, let him be crucified. You see, the majority demanded that Christ be crucified, and Pontius Pilate simply carried out that decree because it was the democratic thing to do. A republic is ruled by laws. Democracy is ruled by the whims of men. And, of course, you have to understand that Carl Sandburg, a very liberal writer, but he recognized what we had in America. As many liberal people do, he said that the republic is a dream. Nothing happens unless first a dream. And America was a dream. It was the dream of men since the beginning of time. And, of course, we had that dream. And we abandoned that dream because, well, we were just too busy to do the studying to understand the foundations of our freedom. If you study the history of civilization, you'll find that all governments have eventually enslaved their citizens. There have been only two instances where men have been free, and on both occasions the populace lost their freedom because they allowed evil men to corrupt their courts. The first instance was 3,000 years ago, when the children of Israel lived under God's law, and there was no formal government. In those days, people could do whatever they wanted as long as they obeyed the Ten Commandments. Samuel was their prophet, and he appointed judges to mediate their grievances, and eventually the judges began to use their position to enrich themselves, and in an effort to remedy the situation, the Israelites asked Samuel to appoint a king to rule over them, because they didn't want to have the corrupt judges. They wanted to have authority to stop the judges from being corrupt, and Samuel told them they should trust God and keep their freedom, but they insisted on having a king. So Samuel prayed and asked the Lord for guidance. And the rest of the story is recorded in 1 Samuel chapter 8. And let me tell you what part of that says. Because you see, it foreshadows what's happening in America. And the Lord said unto Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people and all that they say unto thee. For they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, and I shall not reign over them any longer. According to all the works which they have done since that day that I brought them out of Egypt, even unto this day, wherewith they have forsaken me and served other gods, so do they also unto thee. Now therefore hearken unto their voice, howbeit ye protest solemnly unto them, and show them the manner of the king that shall reign over them. And Samuel told all the words of the Lord unto the people who had asked to have a king. And he said, there will be a manner of the king, thou shalt reign over you. He shall take your sons and appoint them for himself, for his chariots, and to be his horsemen, and some shall run beside his chariots. And he will take their daughters to be his confectionaries, and to be cooks, and to be bakers. And he shall take your fields, and your vineyards, and your olive yard, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. And he shall take a tenth of your seed, and of your vineyard, and give his officers and his servants. And he shall make you men servants, and your maid servants, and your goodliest young men, and your asses, and put them to his work. He will take the tenth of your sheep, and he shall be his servant. And he shall cry out in that day because of your kings, of which he shall have chosen you. And the Lord will not hear you in that day. And I wonder if the Lord is going to hear the cries of the American people as they suddenly begin to cry and ask, of course, to have their freedom back. But, of course, we've turned against God as a nation. And the only thing I can hope for is revival in America. So pray for a revival and pray for our leaders and pray that we will put people into positions of power who fear God. And please remember to pray for Radio Liberty for our provision and protection. So until Monday, may the Lord be with you.